Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 6.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 6. Were there certain basic essential elements in jungle training which you had to adhere to under almost any conditions, Colonel?
In the words of late Colonel Spencer Chapman, the famous Force 136 leader of groups of the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army in Malaya from 1942 until the end of World War II, Spencer Chapman named his book, The Jungle is Neutral. And that is very, very true. The jungle can be a friend and it can be a worst enemy, depending on time, place and circumstances. Jungle varies. It can be like an English wood with teak trees, tremendously tall, flame of the forest, shorter, pretty, whose inner bark one can chew. It can be tall elephant grass or lalang, and you have to plough your way through. So it ranges from the pleasant, quite enclosed, but not impenetrable, English wood or European forest conditions to a mass of impenetrable bamboo which you either have to circumvent or literally cut your way slowly through it, which takes hours and days depending on the conditions. The Chindits under General Lord Wingate found this terribly heavy going on occasions on their first and second raids into northern Burma. In the Budney area, it ranged from up to your thighs in mud before the monsoon rains ended on low-lying ground to crossing a plateau on the last couple of days of our 10-day exercise, which was tremendously picturesque. Water you could get from streams, but you had your sterilisation tablets to put in, and that ensured you had a good supply of water and you carried your own rations on you. Our 10-day exercise, we went off into the jungle and carried out various raids on the demonstration platoon and the permit staff, wading through nullahs up to our knees in water, then putting in a dawn attack, wading back to our firm base. And your firm base was very, very important in the jungle, in that you moved into it off your line of march, leaving as minimum signs as possible, and then settling in quietly, digging in either a shell scrape or a full slit trench, silently as possible. And then once night came, absolute silence. Sentry rosters were 2 hours on and 4 hours off. In Burma, it was to be 2 hours on and 2 hours off. And some nights, everybody on all night. That's lay ahead of us.
Was digging in particularly difficult?
No. We were fit, young, and we adopted the 8th Army dictum, dig or die. And once you got to 14th Army, the slogan there was, dig with the first stop, Australia. Dig or die was the order of the day.
And the slit trench, was it a one-man or a two-man type holding trench?
You can dig for two, you can dig for three, you can dig for four. And you could angle it. But your perimeter faced outwards, and you're in all-round defence in a triangular shape layout, with a section left, a section right, and a section at the rear, the platoon headquarters in the centre. The mules were very good value, and you lined your kit up in two ranks with the mule loads. The mules had a small saddle and harness on, and when the muleteer, who was often one of us on the course, on the month's course, led the mule down, stopped, and a soldier at each side hooked the load on. My first morning with mules was a disaster. We were going down the road, and I'd got the short straw and got a mule that was very cantankerous, what the Indians called a Barbary Waller. And some coolies were coming towards us. One of them had a load of bamboo on his head, and as we got near, he turned towards us so that my mule appeared to think that the bamboo poles were going to strike him. And he reared off. The load went in all directions. He finished up with a Bren gun tripod round his hind legs. We eventually got the stuff collected and put back on him again. But that particular day, the going was tough, and we were up to our knees in mud and water for quite some while on the way out to the training area and on the way back. By the end of the day, I was helping the mule rather than the mule helping me.
What kind of load can a mule carry?
Well, mainly jerry cans of water, jerry cans of fuel, ammunition boxes, ration boxes, and personal kit, and heavy weapons, mortars, and medium machine guns.
Did you become quite close to them? Affectionate?
Well, we only had them for a few days at a time and on the final exercise. But in each battalion, there was a mule platoon, and the officer in charge was a subaltern, and then a mule sergeant, and they had about 30 mules per battalion. And also within the division, mule companies, Indian mule companies. And later on I'll describe a very amusing gymkhana we held in central Burma with our mules, some racing.
You're talking about all-round defence, when you're digging in at night and preparing your defensive perimeter. Did you put out some kind of early warning system for anyone that would be moving in close to you? Obviously, you couldn't see very far.
Generally, you stayed within your own perimeter, because if anyone went out for an ambush, they would generally come back in at first light the next day, because at night, one never fired unless the enemy was on the end of the foresight. This had been a big... There had been a big error in Malaya and the first Burma campaign when the Japs would draw the Allied fire and thus locate the position. And at one stage in India and Burma, the first line ammunition of some Indian battalions was withdrawn to the Bieshlong area before last light, so that they only had their rifles and bayonets. Otherwise, they were knee-deep in empties by first light. And the Japanese had drawn the fire and pinpointed their positions and caused a total waste of ammunition, colossal ammunition expenditure. We observed strict silence and treated all noise at night as hostile, but never opened fire, even on training, until the person with blank, until the person was right close in, and then you fired into the ground on one side, because a blank can be very, very dangerous at close quarters. If patrols went out, then everyone was put fully in the picture as to time out, time back, route out, return route, and password.
Did the password change every night?
Yes.
Moving through the jungle, was there a pattern of movement?
One had to strike a balance between getting too close, thereby presenting a double target to an enemy, or getting too wide apart, losing contact. So according to the thickness of the going, you varied your distance between chaps in the patrol, but usually you went in single file or arrowhead.
Was there a kind of a scout person ahead of you, ahead of your main body?
You often put two chaps up front, a leading scout, and then a second scout, or just a leading scout, and then a chap at the back to watch the rear, because there's always a danger of enemy getting onto the rear of your column.
Were the lessons that had gone on, that had been learned in the previous campaigns in Burma, now being used in this early training?
Absolutely right. And if nothing else, whilst Wingate's first raid didn't achieve any great military success that could perhaps have been done by a bombing raid, although aircraft were in desperate short supply in 1942-43 in Burma, the one major point that Wingate proved was that when he had to, when he was properly trained, and Wingate didn't always have first-line troops, he often had third-line troops in his columns, when properly trained, when they had to do it, when they were away from the city life and the bright lights and became part of the jungle, the white man was as good as the Japanese in the jungle. And lessons were learned from the Malayan disaster and the first Burma campaign and put into very good use.
What kind of food were you getting when you were out in the jungle, away from your base? I'm thinking of the 10-day scheme that you had.
The normal compo rations, tinned food. And I remember as we walked past an Indian hut, a woman gave us a cucumber. But we ate the normal compo, rationed steak and kidney pie, spam, suet pudding, or duff as the soldiers called it, creamed rice, and hardtack biscuits. And of course we kept our water bottles full because the perspiration was streaming out of us. In fact, you also took salt tablets as well as your Mepocrine anti-malarial tablet, because the increased perspiration due to the physical exertion and the temperature, and underneath one's big pack, or certainly even without a pack, the back of your green battle dress was always white, the salt coming through in the perspiration.
Were you able to heat the food safely?
Yes, with small bamboo chip fires and brushwood.
Uniforms, the actual jungle clothing you were wearing, what type
of... We wore bush hats, Australian-type bush hat, and green cellular battle dress top, and then cotton drill, green trousers, boots and putties, and the 1937 pattern webbing. And whereas previously this had been scrubbed bare, it was dipped in dye to make it green, blend with the background. And we carried a normal short muzzle Enfield number one rifle and bayonet and blank ammunition on exercise.
Were there any other weapons coming in at this time to change that?
We had the Sten gun, which was a very rough and ready weapon made for the Home Guard and the forces after Dunkirk. And some units, particularly this training unit, were also trained in the pre-war American Thompson submachine gun, both with the drum and the vertical magazine. And that was a .45 caliber, a very good close-range weapon, as used by the famous Chicago gangsters of the pre-war days, the Capones and Dillingers and Jack Diamonds in this world.
Were there any uses in such close vegetation for the hand grenade? Was that becoming a bit
yes,
dangerous?
Yes, the Mills grenade, the number 36 Mills bomb of World War I fame, was very much in use. And a smoke grenade, which was really a phosphorus grenade, but calling it a smoke grenade got round Geneva Convention and the like, and that was also good for close quarters. We had our own .38 Smith & Wesson revolvers. You either had a Colt .38 or a Smith & Wesson .38. And we were taught how to set up the 36 grenade for an ambush with a piece of wire, attach it to a branch so that anyone coming past would activate it. The grenade had a 4-second fuse. Then for the EY rifle, which was a discharger cup on the end of a Lee Enfield rifle, you fired with the aid of a ballistite cartridge as opposed to the normal ammunition. The ballistite cartridge propelled the 36 grenade for about 100 yards, and that was a 7-second fuse. It also had wire binding round the bodywork of the rifle to strengthen it against the explosion of the ballistite cartridges and the pressures on the barrel. The 2-inch mortar we used, and the people going to mortar platoons, they did mortar training with the 3-inch mortar platoon. When we swam in the nullahs, which some of which were quite wide, sort of rather like small rivers, but tributaries of the Nevada River, the main huge river, you always had a soldier or one of your group stood by with a rifle, with 303 ammunition, in case of attack by a small type of crocodile called a mugger. But we never, fortunately, were never subjected to attack by mugger. The only wild animals I saw were cheetle, deer, in small groups, and then on the way back, in groups of four, on our 10-day exercise, we put up a stag on top of this plateau, and a magnificent animal he was. He'd either be a cheetle or a Samba stag, complete with antlers. I saw pug marks in sand made by tiger, but never actually saw tiger or panther or leopard, although they were in the area.
Did you receive lectures as part of this initial jungle training on, well, obviously on tactics, but on the kind of thing that you could expect from the Japanese?
Yes, the Japanese jitter parties trying to draw fire. The Japanese fanaticism, their famous all-out banzai charges, which were executed with tremendous tenacity and heroism. And we discussed these both in training class and in the mess with chaps who had been up at the 14th Army and had a taste of it, and had come back as instructors or were going back up again to rejoin their battalions and passing on their experiences. Some of the majority of the instructors hadn't actually been in the 14th Army, so getting in someone passing through or specially sent along a first-hand account was invaluable, because they knew what they were talking about.
Was there a picture coming down to you at this early stage again of Japanese cruelties and an attitude that was being formed towards them?
Yes, it was obvious from a lecture we'd already received at the OTS Bangalore from an officer who escaped from Singapore, in which he openly said he never expected to see any of our own prisoners of war again, even at the end of the war, as he'd at an early stage come to the conclusion, and it proved right, that the Japanese intended to work our prisoners until they were all extinct. One realised from the instructors that you had to kill all the Japs, whether they were attacking you or you were attacking them, because even their wounded would try to take you with them. Some would commit suicide, some would try to take you with them. I was to find that out myself at a later stage. But it was quite clear that we were only just holding them. But fortunately, whilst we were still at Bangalore in the May of 1944, when the Japanese 15th Army invaded India and surrounded Kohima and Imphal, and in the Arakan, their thrust there, if those two thrusts had succeeded, with the Arakan thrust and the thrust on Imphal, Kohima, and eventually the railhead of Dimapur, if both those Japanese operations, Yugo and Hugo, had been successful, we could have lost India. So the Arakan battles of 1944, particularly the admin box and the defence of Kohima and Imphal by the 33rd Corps, Kohima, that 4th Corps at Imphal, the 33rd Corps coming up to Dimapur, pushing through the battles of Kohima, at, in and around Kohima, an eventual link-up in which the 4th and 33rd Corps, between them, destroyed the Japanese 15th Army. That was a major turning point in the Far East. MacArthur was doing it in the Pacific, but Slim did it in Manipur and the Arakan.
What were your own feelings about the future, knowing that you were about to step into this very severe and very difficult war?
Let's get up there, let's get on with it. It's got to be done. Somebody's got to do it. We'll bloody well do it.
Are there any other outstanding recollections of this early training?
Some amusing ones. They had a very, very good concert party at the Seven South Lancashires, and when drafts were leaving, one or two before us, then our own, drafts were going up weekly or fortnightly, two of the 14th Army. They put on some very good amusing concert parties, a chap playing the spoons, one ugly looking corporal dressed as a Hawaiian dancer and hopping around the tables in a grass skirt, chaps trying to grope him, much to our amusement, watching from a distance. But one of the most amusing incidents was when we were being taught to set up a 36 Bills grenade for catching out enemy patrols or any enemy passing. And it was always done in the fork of a stream. And one of the students asked the instructor if the grenade was primed or not. And the subaltern asked Sergeant Churchill, was it primed or empty? And he replied, I think it's empty, sir. Within a matter of seconds, they pulled the wire by mistake, and there was a click, whereupon we all leapt up from the ground and dived headlong into the stream. A few chaps, ex-NCOs in the main, had seen this trick before, thought, oh, well, we've seen it all before. But the cunning fellows had left the percussion cap and fuses and just cut the detonator off. So you actually got the click of the lever flying off, the crack of the percussion cap, and the puff of smoke, whereupon a second wave of officers dived into the stream. And there were about 15, 20 officers, all soaking wet. And when we saw the funny side of it, we were laughing like drains. But I must say, it was very well staged and jolly good fun.
Have any recollections of any of your fellow officers or instructors?
Yes, chaps I'd been cadets with, Colin Beale, and we went up to the 14th Army together. A chap from the Royal Lincolns who'd actually been up to the 14th Army, Slogger North. A very good instructor from the Royal Fusiliers, Sergeant Churchill, when we got to 7,000 anchors, I had a very good platoon sergeant, Sergeant Bert Foley from Warrington. They were a Warrington TA battalion, actually. And we enjoyed our training immensely. Mail came quite regularly. It took a long time, usually a month, by sea, but we also got the airmail letter cards, which took about a fortnight to 3 weeks. Some of the mail took anywhere from a month to 2 months, but when you got it, you were glad to get it. And similarly, we wrote back home to friends' relations.
Did you get anything like food parcels or clothing parcels?
Yes. My mother and sister used to knit me some very good long stockings. Because infantrymen march on their feet, quite obviously, and you've got to have jolly good socks and footwear.
Where was the next place you went to after this initial training?
We got on this troop train and spent a week travelling from a small station at Budney up through to Nagpur, and then way up through past Calcutta till we reached the Brahmaputra River, a night journey on paddle steamer, met the train at the other end, and then proceeded to Camilla, where we spent 3 or 4 days in transit. And there, from there, one was allocated to one's battalion, and I was posted to 2 DLI, and then went through a series of reinforcement camps, taking about another 3 days, until I reached Dimapur, which was the railhead and the roadhead for the famous Manipur Road, which ran from Dimapur through Kohima to Imphal in Manipur State, what is now called Nagaland.
Was the terrain changing?
When we were travelling by train towards Dimapur, one could see that one was going into higher ground with ranges of hills covered in jungle. And having arrived at Dimapur, we then detrained and got into motor transport, ready to commence the journey of several hours to our battalions of the 2nd British Infantry Division, which was stretched along the Manipur Road, resting and being reinforced after the battles at Kohima and the link up at Imphal in the May, June, July of 1944. At the base reinforcement camp, I wrote to the CO of 2DLI, asking him if I could go to his battalion, and I still have the letter which he sent to General Headquarters, Delhi, saying that he was many officers short, and could I be posted there. Colin Beale similarly went to the Dorsets. Terry Morse to the Royal Scots, and Bill Cave to the Royal Norfolks.
As you were moving towards your new unit, were you passing signs of warfare?
As one approached Kohima, there was one burnt out tank, and one could see the bare hillsides, which had been the trees of which had been shattered by shell fire and mortar fire and air attack. I was always a very bad traveller. I recounted earlier about being seasick. Well, I was also road sick, air sick, pig sick, every sick. And I didn't feel at all well because the road